consider the idea. More news online at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Chinese economy is taking heavy hit from COVID-19 as well. That's inevitably going to dampen the Chinese ability to disburse financing or continue to support infrastructure projects in developing countries, including Africa, at a rate that it did before.
That's the director of China program at the Stimson Center on how China's role in African financing will change as Beijing grapples with economic recovery from COVID-19. Details coming up also. UN Children's Fund warns millions of children are likely to be pushed into forced labor because of the economic fallout from the COVID pandemic. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As the global coronavirus pandemic impacts economies across the world, there are questions as to how China and Africa relations will be affected and if China will respond to requests for debt relief from African countries. VOA Salim Salamon spoke to China-Africa experts and has this story.
China is Africa's largest trading partner with over $200 billion in combined imports and exports annually. China has also financed billions of dollars of infrastructure projects like roads, ports, and railroads across Africa. The COVID-19 crisis is hindering African countries' ability to repay debt and decreasing China's willingness to invest abroad. Yan Sun is the director of the China program at the Stimson Center. She says China's role in African financing will change as China grapples with economic recovery from COVID-19.
The Chinese economy is taking heavy hit from COVID-19 as well. That's inevitably going to dampen the Chinese ability to disburse financing or continue to support infrastructure projects in developing countries, including Africa, at a rate that it did before.
One of the biggest questions is the future of China's numerous infrastructure projects, including the massive Belt and Road Initiative. The Chinese government, banks, and private investors lent about $146 billion to African countries between 2000 and 2017. Due to COVID-19, many of the world's chief lenders are calling for a pause in payments or debt forgiveness.
So it's not just one African country who is welcoming this global gesture or this global calling for debt relief. But I would say that the picture looks very different from the Chinese side. That first off, given the massive amount of debt that the African countries owe China, whether it is financially feasible for China to forgive those debt is a key question here.
It is estimated that African countries owe a combined $44 billion to service debt this year. Leading global lenders have agreed to pause debt service payments from poor countries. China has said it's open to the idea, but prefers to negotiate terms with individual countries.
The Chinese attitude towards that to begin with is quite resistant. It doesn't mean that China will not engage in, for example, debt renegotiation or debt restructuring or even postponement to offer longer grace period for the African countries to pay back their debt. But I think a blanket debt forgiveness is not in the cards to begin with.
Hannah Ryder runs a business consultancy based in Beijing. She says many African leaders believe taking a debt is essential to building the national infrastructure to jumpstart economies and lift citizens out of poverty.
It's never great to have debt. But the reason why African leaders have decided to go into debt to fund different infrastructure projects, to fund, you know, energy, roads, etc., is because those are badly needed on the continent.
Ryder says China is one of the G20 countries that has agreed to cut debt servicing costs to 77 poor countries, freeing up an average of $260 million per country this year.
There are going to be some infrastructure projects that will go bust, that won't be working as a result of COVID-19. And those issues need to be looked at in a much more kind of detailed structural way.
But concerns remain as to how China will react to an inability by African countries to repay loans in the long term. Salim Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
A joint report by the International Labor Organization and UN Children's Fund warns millions of children are likely to be pushed into forced labor because of the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, the two agencies are launching a report titled COVID-19 and Child Labor, A Time of Crisis, to mark World Day Against Child Labor Day today.
Authors of the report warn the global pandemic is likely to reverse decades of steady progress made in reducing the number of child laborers. Over the past 20 years, the International Labor Organization says child labor has decreased by 94 million. The latest figures put the number of child laborers globally at 152 million, nearly half of them in what is called hazardous child labor. Those jobs are particularly dangerous and hazardous to the physical and mental well-being of children. They include work in the agriculture, mining, construction, manufacturing, and domestic sectors. The report warns millions of children are likely to be forced into the worst forms of labor as COVID-19 wreaks havoc on the economy and families have no means of support. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. The senior researcher and ILO lead author of the report, Lorenzo Guarcello, tells VOA evidence is growing that child labor is rising as schools close during the pandemic. He says many children who do not go to school are likely to be forced into exploitative and hazardous jobs.
Families are sending children to sell in the street some food, flowers, so already they are starting to work. They are much more exposed to work in hazardous condition because of the likely increase of involvement in the informal sector.
Guarcello says Africa has the largest number of child laborers. Of the 72 million child laborers, he says 31.5 million are in hazardous work. He says most are employed in the agriculture sector.
We know that working in agriculture exposes children to hazardous conditions, working long hours, being exposed to the heat for the full day, using dangerous machinery, and so on.
Guarcello says the ILO and UNICEF are developing a simulation model to look at the global impact of COVID-19 on child labor. He says new global estimates will be released next year. Among its recommendations, the joint report is calling for comprehensive social protection and easier access to credit for poor households to counter the threat of child labor. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A huge percentage of children in child labor are in the agricultural sector. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi speaks with a food and agriculture organization, FAO, child labor expert, to get a better understanding of the situation.
Beyond Zeifeld is a child labor expert with FAO. He says agriculture accounts for most children who work.
Worldwide, 152 million girls and boys are trapped in child labor, and the striking 71% of all child labor is found in agriculture. The region with most child labor remains Africa, followed by the Asia and Pacific region. In Africa, we have 72 million girls and boys in child labor in agriculture, and globally, 108 million girls and boys are in child labor. in agriculture.
Zeifeld says one out of five children in Africa are involved in child labor. It is often difficult for many African families to tell between a child working on the family fields and what qualifies as child labor.
To be mindful of what is child labor and what is actually not child labor is very important. Looking at Africa, where many children grow up on farms and helping out on and around the farm is just part of normal upbringing. But if children work so many hours every week that they do not benefit from the compulsory schooling as determined by law in their country, then this would be considered child labor.
He adds that exposing children to toxic pesticides and having them climb tall trees or use sharp tools is also considered child labor. Zeifeld says about 70% of child labor globally is unpaid family work, and the main factor is poverty, where families have to rely on their children for their upkeep. While the world battles with the COVID-19 pandemic, Zeifeld worries about its impact on child labor.
This year, the World Against Child Labor looks in particular at the impact of the COVID pandemic on the situation of child labor in agriculture for the FAO. The COVID pandemic has pushed certainly many more families around the world into poverty, and this leads to more child labor. There are no statistics at this point on the magnitude of this problem.
FAO has been pushing for an end to child labor, and part of the effort includes tailoring their programs to make them child labor sensitive. At country levels, they have been urging government ministries of finance, agriculture and labor to work hand in glove on the issue. There is an ambitious target to end child labor by 2025, and Zeifeld says breaking through in the agricultural sector is key to the fight. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
The Egyptian role in Libya has surged since President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi ascended to power in 2014, supporting Libyan retired General Khalifa Haftar as a trusted partner to use his self-proclaimed Libyan National Army to contain Islamist threats on its western borders. As Haftar aspired to rule Libya by force, Egypt became the main supplier of arms and training. When he failed to take over Tripoli, Egypt launched an initiative for a political solution. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the Egyptian role in Libya with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington.
While Haftar has cooperated with the United States and other countries in fighting jihadists, that has not been his primary goal in Libya. It's been fighting the Western government, and he's even let jihadists pass through his territory when the higher goal was fighting against his political enemies. Second of all, he's got more Islamists fighting him than the other side. And so it's a bit of a canard to say that Islamism is his main target. I would say that both Sisi and Haftar do not have democracy as their main goal and have been working against democracy, but I don't think that's their primary goal either. I think their primary goal is developing a political and economic system that supports themselves and their political and economic allies, a corrupt and authoritarian system, and then justifying that system in a push for stability, even though it's been proven that over time, this type of system does not create much stability. It actually provokes instability. And so it's those systemic goals of taking over and then dominating the system to their own interests and their own vision, which is primarily motivating this conflict, not the ideological aspects that often get emphasized in the coverage.
Egypt became the main gateway for providing Haftar with weapons from the United Arab Emirates, Egyptian logistical and intelligence support to his failed campaign to take over Tripoli while repeating Egyptian calls for political solution in Libya. How do you explain that?
The Egyptian is similar to the Russian position and not similar to the Emirati position. The Emiratis, like the Turks, are all in for one side, whereas the Egyptians, like the Russians, are supporting Haftar militarily, but they are also supporting a negotiated solution because their assessment is that their interests are best represented not by one side having total victory over the other, but by a negotiation in which their side has the upper hand in negotiations. And so the military support that Russia and Egypt give to Haftar are about having better political outcomes in the end, even if the solution probably has to be negotiated. Egypt's primary concern right now and in general is terrorists coming across the border and the stability of the border. And then secondarily, it's about the economic benefits that Egypt derives from a stable Libya. And ultimately, Egypt can live with anyone running Libya as long as its primary objectives in Libya are met.
Last week, President Sisi launched an initiative for a ceasefire and resumption of negotiations to reach a political solution in Libya. Could Egypt be a peace broker in Libya after backing one side in the Libyan civil war?
Ultimately, you want your peace broker to be neutral. But that's often not the case in international politics. Just to take the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, where often the U.S. is the lead broker, but it also sides with one conflict. However, the U.S. is the best broker. This is not the case for Egypt in this case, though, because they're not the major power broker in the conflict. In the Libyan case, it's more that all of the countries that are concerned with Libya, the sort of 10 or 15 countries most involved, and Egypt is one of them, have to help build peace. They all have to be peace brokers. And Egypt at times has shown that willingness, and they've played a major role, for example, in the economic peace process at the UN related to Libya. They're housing a lot of Libyan refugees, et cetera, et cetera. But they are not in a position to force a solution, nor to be the main broker in a solution, even though they're playing a very important role. So, for example, the recent meeting in Cairo, in which this peace plan was announced, was not very important in terms of the overall ultimate UN deal, but it was important in that it brought the two sides of the Eastern government back together that had been estranged to some degree for about a month now, after General Haftar abandoned the parliament that put him into power. And so forcing the Eastern parliament and the Eastern military commander to come up with a common position actually played a positive role in Libya peacemaking. And this was said yesterday by the American Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs, David Schenker. So commonality of positions regarding the Libyan conflict, both domestically and internationally, are important, and Egypt can play a role there.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. A 41-year-old national of the Gambia has been arrested in the U.S. city of Denver, Colorado, for allegedly inflicting severe physical pain and suffering on six people who were suspected of plotting a failed coup attempt against then-President Yahya Jammeh in 2006. The indictment alleges that Michael Sankorea, a former member of the Gambian armed unit known as the Junglers, conspired with others to carry out the torture. The Junglers allegedly received orders from Jammeh and answered to him. Correa made his first court appearance yesterday before a U.S. magistrate judge in the District of Colorado. South Africa's Drakensberg Boys Choir School has uploaded a YouTube video shot on cell phones during the COVID-19 lockdown. It features the song Smile, composed by funny man Charlie Chaplin, and later, when lyrics were added, made famous by greats like Nat King Cole and Jimmy Durante. The school's artistic director, Bernard Kruger, says it was done as a project to try to compensate for people's not being able to do live performances. He chatted with reporter Vicky Stark and told her, "They chose the song because it urges people to stay positive during tough times."
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. There are clouds in the sky. You'll get by if you smile. Set in the UNESCO World Heritage Site of the majestic Drakensberg Mountains in KwaZulu-Natal province, the school presently has just 100 pupils, ages 9 to 15, all handpicked through an audition process. Kruger says the school is the only one of its kind in Africa.
As a choral institution, there are very few of these places in the world where the whole school is actually based around the choir and the education that we provide, a music education.
And just how in demand is this boys' choir?
Last year, we were invited by Disney to go and take part and perform in the 20th anniversary concert of The Lion King on the West End. So we performed there as a special guest. In 2018, we were invited to a choral festival in Switzerland. In 2017, we did a concert tour in Japan of 25 cities.
Kruger says the lockdown has been very damaging financially because school fees aren't enough to keep things running.
Because of the high costs involved and the high staff numbers ratio that we have here on campus, we need to supplement that income with concerts and performances, and that's what we've been doing for the last few years. And now that that little tap has run dry, it's quite important for us to find other ways of funding. So that's why we've been putting out a lot more content on social media and on YouTube to see if we can engage with people in different ways.
13-year-old Kwezi Msimang features in the Smile YouTube video. He says he had to pass a voice test to get into the school in 2017.
The Drakensberg Boys Choir came to perform at my old school, and I was amazed at how they performed, and I wanted to be a part of that choir. So then I went to the open weekend in March, and they chose me, they selected me to come.
The youngster, whose father died in a car accident 2 years ago, ends the video with an appeal for people to subscribe to the school's YouTube channel and the words, "Remember, music heals the soul." He says each of the 16 boys in the chamber choir recorded the song on their own mobile phones, then sound engineer and former pupil Chad Zerf put it all together.
I felt really good. I felt part of all of us that recorded it. It was amazing.
Kruger says they've been fortunate to be able to provide online education to the boys during lockdown.
But it definitely isn't the same. It's not the same as having all the boys together in a rehearsal. They can't experience the emotional connection to any kind of music making if they're stuck by themselves in a room in their house. So it has been a challenge, but we're hopeful that our boys will be returning to campus, you know, in the next week or so.
This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbiya Baro, thanks again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny.